The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world. What's the matter with our marriages today? They're falling apart. About one out of three in the United States today becoming divorced. Every year, a little over 1,800,000 eager, hopeful young people march down the aisle and then out again with the tunes of the wedding march still ringing in their ears and rice, the chances are, in their hair. What happens in the course of a few months or years to bring these same people down another aisle only a few years later to rend asunder that marriage they had tried to put together? What happens to us? Why is it that in the United States and increasingly in Scandinavia, in Great Britain, in South Africa, and in Australia, the big fun nations of affluence, of the technological glitter and glamour of a modern world of science and industry, our homes are falling apart? Well, I've been talking about American courtship and what leads to marriage, the practices of finding a mate, and what is it that takes place before that couple walks down the aisle. But the deep sociological problems involved are almost incomprehensible today. By now, you've all heard about some of the riots along the famed Sunset Strip in Hollywood or Beverly Hills in the Los Angeles area. But have you heard what policemen are saying about it? About what kind of kids these are? One police official, after battling youths along Hollywood Sunset Strip, said, "It's strange. They riot and break the law and then have the nerve to tell us they're doing it because we enforced the law in the first place. Some of these kids are real nothings," he said, "but the majority of them come from good, solid families with money in the bank, plenty of food on the table, and a bright future ahead of them." A sheriff's officer had this view. He said the real trouble here is that too many parents don't know or don't care where their children are at night. From a leading newspaper in the United States, one girl was quoted. She had smiled and said, "My parents don't know where I am, nor do they care. My mother and I don't exactly communicate." That's an interesting new kind of terminology our youngsters are using. They don't use the term get along or talk things over, but now they've heard from some high school professors or college professors communicate. I wonder if they know the meaning of the term. A juvenile court judge who watched the curfew violators recently flow in and out all last weekend, and he was talking to them. And remember, one out of six young kids under 18 that you meet has been before a juvenile court judge. He said the parents come in here absolutely infuriated. It's not that the kids are out until all hours that bothers them. It's that we called them and pulled them away from some party of their own. So said a juvenile court judge. I happen to know an awful lot of married people. I've talked with a lot of them. I want to read to you an excerpt from a letter that we received here in Pasadena, California. Someone said it was only a few years ago they began here in the World Tomorrow program. They began reading some of the literature and so on. And this person wrote and said, "I hate to tell you of how miserable and hate-filled a marriage we had. Now, this marriage has been changed. This one has been totally set aright. But this was previously." And this person said, "My husband and I," mentioned the word unconverted, meaning before they got their eyes open and began to change a little bit. They said, "We didn't share the same bedroom. The only time we spoke to one another was a hateful snarl or screaming and fighting. He must have despised me. When he did address me, it was a curse word. He was filthy, worked in grease all day, and wouldn't bathe month in and month out. Many would come home in greasy clothes and sit in front of the TV set. Year after year, this went on," she said. "We shared nothing together, did nothing together in 7.5 years of marriage. When he had to pay the bills, he'd scream and rage and smash things, furniture, me, everything, although he could well afford it." Well, she didn't think he'd ever change, but there was a terrific change, and she said the night he came home from work and showered, shaved, and put on dress pants, "I won't ever forget it. Such a small thing, no beginning of a miracle for a man whose body had been caked with grease week after week for 7.5 years. This is an extreme case, but I want to read it anyhow, because she said he only shaved every third day. A day or two before that, she'd prayed, well, just make him clean up. But, you know, the key was found in the statement this woman made. Quote, I had to ask God to show me things in him to respect. I didn't respect him. I couldn't stand him. But she began to ask God in prayer. She believed in God. That's not too terribly unusual, although increasingly becoming a little more unusual than it used to be. But she asked God to show her what was wrong with her and to show her the good points to think about, and her example began to change the pattern of that marriage. Millions of couples today live together as absolute strangers. I was talking to a friend of mine recently that said in the past 5 years he and his wife had spoken an average of 5 minutes to each other every day. That was only the necessary communication to get the kids off to school, to get out of bed, to get breakfast over with, and to get to the job and back home in the evening and find out who's going to watch what on TV. But people do not, like the young girl who said she and her mother don't exactly communicate. No, people do not exactly communicate. And in the average American family, there is precious little discussion of the really big issues at hand. People don't discuss news. They don't discuss world trends. They don't discuss their hopes and their dreams and their plans. They don't discuss the methods of child rearing, or the diet, or their own habits at home. They don't sit down and discuss philosophically and theoretically involving the big issues of religion or economics or the social issues with which they have to come to grips. They don't discuss their hobbies or their jobs or their problems at home. But they've got a mutter, a snarl, and a curse. They've got a flippant, sarcastic statement to make, or they've got somebody to invite over for bridge, but there isn't very much communication going on in the average American marriage today, nor the average British marriage, for that matter. Now, divorce counselors are saying most marriages fail because of the inability of either or both partners to love anyone but themselves. So let's just philosophize a little about it together. Marriage is supposedly based upon love. Now, you could get an argument on that one from a few people who are so way out, they think marriage is only a passing social phenomenon and that soon it's going to be out of date and totally changed. But the concept of what is marriage belongs in this discussion. What is marriage in the first place? Just what is it? What constitutes marriage? How is a marriage preserved? How is it maintained? Where did it come from? Why is it? Who invented it? When did it start? Who were the very first married people on earth? Now, you know, you can come up with a lot of answers, but I mean, if you were going to get at the absolute historical truth of that, the basis of society we know is marriage. The basis of any culture or any nation, for that matter, is marriage, because a nation is merely a family of people grown great into a nation, and it has the same root derivation, etymologically speaking, N-A-T, from nativity. We use it in the word natural. We talk about prenatal and postnatal, and it's the same root that we have in the term nation, because nation means family. It has to do with birth. The land of your nativity is the land of your birth. From a tribe to a country, from a family to a nation, believe it or not, like it or not, accept it or not, the human race came from one original couple. And at the time of Noah, believe it or not, accept it or not, like it or not, the basic colors and the basic racial stocks of humankind came from three separate families of Shem and his wife, and Ham and his wife, and Japheth and his wife, and that's a fact. Now, the fact that you can still find their names indelibly stamped on the earth today, isn't that a little bit significant? The Japhetic people, being the yellow races, as we say. Or do you come up with a name like J-A-V-A-N, Javan? Javanese, the island of Java. Where do you find a name like J-A-P-A-N, Japan, or the Japanese, and they're the Japhetic people? All these names are indelibly stamped around the world if we take the trouble to find out about racial origins and where nations and families came from. We in this world are a great human family. And if people understood their national and their individual origins a little better, they might get rid of some of their racial prejudices along with it. With that increased understanding about how it is that all people are of one blood, like it or not. Now, in our private families, people have not really analyzed what is marriage, why is marriage, what is it for, and why should it be protected and preserved. They don't seem to realize there is a great inventor of marriage who set down certain specific laws to preserve and protect a marriage and to make it the absolute, wonderful, blissful relationship that young starry-eyed kids think it's supposed to be. Now, increasingly, they think nothing of the kind because the so-called new morality is watering down the last little vestige of anything you could call ethics, mores, laws, culture. And let's forget about the hoods, finks, beatniks, and hoodlums for a moment and think about people who do stand for something, who do have a few values, who are a little concerned about the future. In our families today, we've got nothing but problems. People disagree on methods of treating their children. They get into arguments over their education, their religion, their allowances, their food. People live together as absolute strangers, snatching and grabbing at opportunity, satiating themselves with physical, temporal, sensual pleasures, thinking only of entertainment, of the TV set, of the motion pictures, of card games, of entertainment. But being together as a family, plowing under your own talents and abilities and aptitudes and interests inside the home and the family, husbands and wives sitting down and talking deeply about the things that are mutually of a concern to both of them, they just don't do it. The average person gives little, if any, thought to anything philosophical or beyond himself because he finds himself fearful of this modern age in which we live. It's an age of confusion, an age of dark, macabre fear and doubt, an age of people wondering about the peril of mankind, fearful to face the big issues and the problems, afraid of what they might discover, so they simply don't talk about it. I find it increasingly difficult to talk to people in business about the big issues that confront mankind. They not only don't want to talk about it, they don't want to hear about it. You start mentioning the population explosion and give the absolute statistical analyses and the facts that in 10 short years many areas of this earth are going to totally double in population. You talk about the current problems that means in India and how the United States, at the depletion of vast reserves, has only succeeded in forestalling inevitable starvation, reaching multiple millions of people over there for only about one more year. And people begin to get a little, a little hesitant. They want to change the subject. They get a little tight around the collar. Their toes begin to kind of clench in their socks and shoes, and they get a little nervous. You find them kind of twitching their ankle and crossing and uncrossing their leg and trying to change the subject. They just don't want to face those facts. It's too big for us, and people aren't talking about them in marriage. You talk about the mounting crime picture. Quote a few succinct statistics to absolutely prove this dog-eared, yellow-leafed, outdated adage about it's only better reporting is absolutely not true, and that crime is rising out of all proportion to the increase of populations, and people get to tugging at their neckties, and they want to change the subject. Now, recently, one newspaper editorial column said anyone who seeks to analyze and define this age in tangible terms is likely to experience a sense of bafflement. It's an age of contradictions, of challenging paradoxes. In a time when men are seeking to explore the stars, they're finding it increasingly difficult to solve the problems which affect them on this planet. And in a period when technology promises to usher in a new scientific utopia in which everyone will be happy, millions are gripped with a feeling of insecurity. Small wonder someone has called this an age with a split personality. And small wonder the average marital couple will not discuss their problems. They won't discuss trends, conditions, religion, world affairs, their home, their hobbies, their interests, or their jobs. Because everybody is playing a fantastic, bizarre game of hide-and-go-seek, of escapism. When Dad comes home from the job, he wants to escape the job, and he doesn't want the full-time responsibility of Mom and the kids. And when Mom comes home, the 40% or better of them in American life who have their own jobs because they covet and lust after the material things they think are going to make their lives happier, they come home all exhausted because they've been managing the office or decorating somebody else's home or out trying to sell somebody else's house instead of worrying about their own, and they've got a job to pull down a combined income of X number of thousands a year so they can belong in a certain social stratum that appeals to them. Why? Because of the vanity of what other people think about them, we're a nation of people trying to keep up with the Joneses. And we care so much about the prestige and the aplomb and the importance of what other people have to say about us, of their opinions of us, that we'll sacrifice our kids to the grist mill of crime and the police on the street and then get the phone call at night and wonder why it is our kid is before the juvenile judge and say, well, I'm utterly dumbfounded. I've always done everything for him, given him everything he wanted. Always treated him real square. What's that little fink doing down there at the police station? Has he got no respect? Has he got no sense of appreciation for all these wonderful things I've done for him? 3 square meals a day, a bedroom in which to live, a school he can go to. No father, of course, No long talks, no trips to the woods together, no companionship, no family life, no morning study, no eating of meals together and teaching him the things he needs to know. I never explained to him what makes clouds and why it rains. I never told him about household physics, like what causes the coffee pot to bubble and where steam comes from. I've never taken him out on the lawn at night and told him about the pock marks on the moon. I've never discussed with him where we get our oxygen through photosynthesis and about the growing things around us. I've never observed things in nature and taught my kid, but I've given him 3 squares a day. What's the ungrateful brat doing down at the police station? LSD, you say? My kid? Ridiculous, the parents say. My kid would never take drugs. My kid would never sniff glue. My kid would never be a pill gulper. Well, the police say that parents are utterly dumbfounded when they find some of their children down at the police station, and they're so incredulous, oftentimes they say, I just don't believe it. It can't be my kid, you must have somebody else. But what the parents don't seem to realize is they themselves are to blame, and that we have become a nation of parental delinquents. That we have abrogated our parental responsibilities, and our divorce rate and our mounting crime rate and our growing juvenile delinquency rate, and especially drug addiction, promiscuity, and absolute epidemic proportions in venereal disease among teenagers are the proofs of that statement, that we are a nation of parental delinquents. Now, there are no reliable statistics on just how widespread drug addiction is among the young, because only a fraction of those addicted get caught. But police know that 48% of all persons arrested for serious offenses in 1964 in the United States were under 18 years of age. And all you've got to do is to talk to law enforcement officials in any large city in the United States, and you will find they are convinced that a shockingly large number of these juvenile crimes are committed by youngsters under the influence of drugs, especially crimes of brutality, of growing violence, like the elderly man who was set afire recently in Los Angeles. Teenage thugs jumped out of an automobile, demanded his money. When he had none, they poured gas on him and set him afire and burned him so severely that the last report I heard, he was just barely hanging on to life by a thread, lying in absolute agony in the hospital. Police records are full of violence and crime committed by juvenile glue addicts. Car theft and rape are the most common among this group, joyriding or rape. Sergeant Eugene Zappi, who is head of the Los Angeles Juvenile Narcotics Squad, said, and I quote, not a day goes by that we don't pick up kids for sniffing glue or taking pills. They've been told that sniffing glue can absolutely do their minds in for the rest of their lives, destroy their mental capacity, damage the brain beyond repair, but they'll still do it. He said when we ask the parents what they know about these activities, almost invariably they react with shocked surprise. They're astonished that the police would even think that their youngsters were fooling around with dangerous drugs. And most of the teenage addicts we talked to came from unbroken homes in solid middle-class communities. I'll tell you this. If divorce is striking close to 1 out of 3 homes, the statistics about the numbers of homes that are just not really homes, but sort of a glorified motel where 2 people are living in the same area, but with nothing else that goes toward putting together a home, would be somewhat staggering. The many homes that show the cracks and the decay of the beginning erosion that is going to eventually lead toward de facto divorce, where people are in a sense separated though they're living together, but the marriage is gone. If the statistics were available on that, if we were shockable, and I think we're becoming unshockable, then we would be shocked. Well, the sergeant's words are underscored by dozens of other police officials. These men have seen a great deal of the seamy side of life, and without exception, they are shocked by the rising tide of juvenile drug addiction. Linked with juvenile drug addiction is the horrifying increase in automobile accidents among the younger set. Captain Joseph Healy, head of the Illinois Narcotics Control Agency, said, the kids are taking these pills with beer and going crazy. They get into all kinds of car accidents when they're high. They can't seem to get it through their heads that these pills are dynamite. Seeking a thrill, apparently, has become more important than preserving life, than thinking about the future, than education, than any set of moral principles or laws that ought to be observed and obey. And why is that? Well, I'll tell you why it is. It's because parents have not instilled a sense of true values, a desire to build right character, have not instilled a sense of reward for obedience and of the penalty for disobedience in their children. They haven't built character in their children. They haven't given them the love and the correction and the guidance and the discipline that those children so desperately need. And in their own minds and in their own confessions, many a teenager has said, I wish my parents would be a little more strict. I wish they would tell me more when to get in and how far to go and what to do on a date and who to date and when can I bring my friends over and so on. They want that parental guidance, but they're not being given it. Because we've become a generation of lust-seeking, thrill-seeking, beer-guzzling, T-shirted, double-stomached characters who sit around and do nothing but seek our own physical pleasures instead of giving ourselves our abilities, our minds, our life, our time, our energy to our children. Because too many people don't seem to know why we have children other than just little annoying house apes. They don't know why we have marriages, what they're for, what they're all about, which means to say they don't know the purpose of human life. They don't know why we exist and why we're alive, why we live, where we're headed, how we're going to finally turn out. It's about time you took a look at your marriage and you ask yourself, where are you going in life? What is ahead? Why are you married? What is the end product? Walk through the years ahead and see what you see. What do you want out of life? To fight the battle of youth for the next 20 years? You women crowding 40. You going to keep fighting it when you're 60? What about 70? Is there ever a time in your life you want to sit back and see the young grandchildren around you and to enjoy it as a mature woman should, gracefully and graciously, and have a full life when that time comes? Or you don't want to kind of forced all it off and wear all your contrivances and contraptions and claim you're 39 when you're really 67 and then sort of fall apart all at once? What do you want to do? Drop dead on the street from a stroke? Or grow old graciously? I begin to get a little disgusted when I see some of the, what do we call them, middle-aged or elderly among us that just won't admit their age. Here's some frizzy blonde walking down the street. And she's got seamless nylons and heelless shoes and a black dress and a low-slung handbag and a kind of a wanton look on her face. You know what she is? She's the mother of three teenage kids. Where are they? They're probably over on the strip rioting while she's out looking for a thrill because she's been busy all day long trying to sell somebody else's home. Now, you can kid yourself this isn't true, but that's what you'd be doing. You'd be enjoying a kind of a bizarre joke on yourself. Now, it's not enough for us to hear of some straw-headed young actress who has suddenly, quote, discovered, end quote, herself, and has learned how to live for the moment. That's not going to do you any good. That makes attractive copy to some people. But that's not the stuff of which full and abundant lives are made. That's going to end up in strained, miserable, wretched, futile, frustrated, empty lives, broken homes, a hollow shell of what once was supposed to be a marriage, but which now is nothing more than a casual social acquaintance. It's about time we began to look into our own homes and marriages and ask ourselves, are they worth saving? I'll tell you this, if they were worth getting into in the first place, they're worth saving. Anything worth doing is worth doing well. Marriage is worthwhile. It ought to be entered into with great caution and studious, careful consideration after great counsel and a lot of prayer. Instead of rushing off down the hill with somebody you scarcely know. Have you seen that prospective mate thwarted? Have you seen that person frustrated? Have you seen them disappointed? Have you seen them happy? Do you know all of their hobbies? Do you know their likes and dislikes? Do you know their background? Do you know their religious ideas and philosophies? Do you know their child-rearing concepts? Do you know what they believe with regard to race and religion? You know what kind of a homemaker they're going to be? Just because a kid owns a convertible and a surfboard hardly makes him a good candidate for a husband and a father. Just because a girl's got straw hair and a nice walk hardly means she's going to follow right child-rearing principles. But our young people are out sharing nothing more than hours of the kind of experience that should be reserved for marriage and wonder why it blows up in their face in a few weeks. I'm going to talk for a few broadcasts again because we had such interest in it. When I talked about it on the World Tomorrow program, We had so many letters that said they wanted more, so I'm going to give you some more. And it's not my ideas. I've got behind me the weight of the opinions of centuries. And I've got behind me the statistics of marital counselors and divorce lawyers from many nations. And I've got behind me the philosophers, the writers, the historians, the artists, and the law enforcement agents, and all the rest of them. And I've got behind me something more than that. A book that has been written by the author of marriage, by the inventor of it, by the one who designed it, and by the one who engineered it, by the one who set it up as being the state in which humankind ought to perpetuate itself. And a very great type of the very purpose in human life. And I'm going to begin with seven major keys in selecting a mate, and maybe give you one program on each one of them. Seven major keys in how to select a mate in the right kind of dating. And then come to what is marriage and why is it and how do you preserve it? And then how to solve family arguments and how to maybe reconcile if you are about to decide you can't stand the old hag or the old bear anymore. But if you're thinking about it one way or the other, it's about time you did yourself one of the greatest favors of your life and you wrote in for these articles on how to have a happy marriage and the one on how to solve family arguments. How to have a happy marriage and how to solve family arguments. They're free of charge. There's no price for them. Now, in the booklet on child rearing, on the plain truth about child rearing is one little brief section on training your children together. But there's a great deal here that parents really badly need. The plain truth about child rearing. What is a child? When do they begin learning? How do you train them? What about discipline? What about positive patient instruction? Here is the whole concept of what's wrong with our youngsters today. And guilt placed right at the door where guilt belongs, but also how to train your children in the way that really pays off and gets the results you're looking for. It's free of charge, no price. Now, also in the current number of the Plain Truth magazine, you'll have this article on the real danger behind the common market prosperity. In 1944, this broadcast was saying Germany would rise again. Is there any question about it in anybody's mind today? There was then. There isn't now. Things that we were saying decades ago coming to pass before your eyes. Now, Mr. Kiesinger's grand coalition is a reality. And the NPD in Bavaria is a reality. And also, Franz Josef Strauss, who you know once had to resign from his position as defense minister, is now the minister of finance in West Germany. It's about time you found out what it means, but also about newfound continental prosperity and what might occur if that prosperity were threatened. What's happening behind the scenes in Europe? The Plain Truth magazine keeps you abreast of world affairs, and if you want something to discuss in your home, here's an article and a magazine that will make you talk about it. So write in for the Plain Truth magazine. It's free of charge, no price, full color, 52 pages, letters from the editor from around the world, and other articles and features such as the Bible story for children, every single issue, if you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Remember, there is no charge. The articles on how to have a happy marriage, on how to solve family arguments, the booklet, The Plain Truth About Child Rearing, and The Plain Truth Magazine. They're free, no price. The address again in just a moment. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.